Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Radio Network. You can go to my website, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, Total Tutor, and Pinterest, Neil Haley. And the excitement is just, May is just unbelievable. The World Radio Challenge, all these different awesome opportunities. But I'm a huge fan of this athlete, so I'm so excited to welcome the program. Author, Clearing Hurdles, The Quest to Be the World's Greatest Athlete, gold medalist, Dan O'Brien. Dan, thanks for calling.
My pleasure. Glad to be here. Thanks.
Oh, I mean, Dan, the memories absolutely of that time period when you won the gold medal, and I guess the PR around you was just unbelievable, wasn't it? For sure.
Yeah, it really was. I think what happened in 1992 when we had the Dan and Dave commercials and then I didn't make the team that year, there was a lot of hype for me going into the 96 games. And, you know, I lucked out in the fact that they just happened to fall in the United States in Atlanta.
So that's interesting in a lot of ways because I don't remember. I just remember the commercial, honestly. I mean, and then I remember, and I always just assumed you were awesome in 92. So that's kind of a good point of the, I guess, calling your title Clearing Hurdles, because you did have to go through some hard times to finally get to the gold medal, it sounds like.
Well, I really did, and part of my book just talks about, you know, my upbringing and going to college and all the mistakes that I made along the way. I was really the first kid in a really big family, even in my extended family, to go to college, and so I kind of went to college flying blind, made a lot of mistakes, flunked out, had to go to junior college, came back to Division I, only got to really compete one solid year before I really made an impact in the sport of track and field. And then even as I became a pro, I struggled with injuries and some different things, but I put a nice team together and was able to win the gold in 96.
So in 92, with all that build up to that Olympics and then not making the team, how hard was that?
As an athlete, you're prepared to lose just as much as you are prepared to win. You've been running and jumping and playing sports and basketball, football, baseball, and things like that your whole entire life. So, I think when you have a major setback like that, it hurts. But your first instinct is to just continue to work hard and continue to train. I think the most difficult thing about it is, you know, dealing with the people around you, dealing with your family and your friends and your community. I think everybody around me took the loss a lot harder than I actually took it myself. I just knew that I needed to work harder. But, you know, to a lot of other people, it appeared to be a chance of a lifetime that had slipped away. But, you know, I certainly wasn't going to give up at that point. And with my team, I really dominated the decathlon for the next 4 years.
And it motivated you, especially because you had the status of, you know, you are a superstar based on the commercials. They said, you know what, I got to go out there and prove myself. And you've dealt with that struggle throughout your life. And I'm sure life after track is part of your book as well. It didn't end there, did it? For sure.
No, it didn't, and I think that's what's interesting about Olympic athletes. You know, a lot of those careers are done at a very early age. You know, I was 30 when I won the gold medal, and honestly, I didn't know what I wanted to do afterwards. So, you know, all of our stories, all of our Olympic athletes, you know, we have stories that continue on, and it's very difficult because you're so passionate about your sport. It's hard to find things in life that you're passionate about later, and so there's always a real transition going from being a professional athlete. You know, especially for me, track and field athlete, to not being an athlete.
So life after, I've talked to a lot of Olympians, Dan, and professional athletes, NFL players, NBA, they just don't know what they're going to do. And you kind of mentioned that before. When you finally had to hang it up, you said it was difficult, but who kind of was a mentor or someone to help you in the process so that you were ready for life after?
You know, it was interesting. I got an opportunity to coach track and field at Arizona State University. Coach Greg Kraft, my wife and I were girlfriend at the time. My wife and I moved to Scottsdale, Arizona, and I really wasn't doing much. I just was playing golf and doing, you know, kind of was on the lunch circuit doing appearances and speeches and some, you know, some endorsement opportunities here and there. But I really didn't do a whole bunch for 5 or 6 years, and I was at the track just working out myself, and Coach said, said, look, we've got some athletes we'd love for you to come on board and help us with. I started coaching and just realized, you know, this is really what I'm passionate about and what I love. And so I got more involved in track and field as a coach and as an administrator. So I work closely with USA Track and Field now. I still volunteer at Arizona State University, but, you know, to touch these lives of athletes that are trying to achieve the same goals and dreams that I had is really something I'm passionate about now.
You see that you want to give back from your success and help others so that they don't make some of the mistakes you made, or also learn from the falls, the difficulties, Dan, that you fell on the ground at times and thought, hey, am I going to get back up? And you did get back up. And that's one reason why you wrote the book, is to really let people know being a professional athlete and reaching the highest level does not mean it's going to come easy. And there's going to be hurdles in your life, as, again, using the title in a lot of ways, throughout your life, after sports to whatever career you're going to be in.
Well, and that's really the message of the book, is that nothing comes without failure beforehand. And you know, I do some personal training now. I'm in the fitness industry. You know, some of the things I talk to people about is that, you know, we're doing things that we're not very good at, and the way that we get over these things is consistency. Just doing it every single day. How do you lose weight? Show up every day. How do you get better? You show up every day. And so, yeah, there's a lot of similarities to, you know, what I did as a track and field athlete, to just, you know, things that people go through in their lives, and that you need to live each day as a singular day, and you can't let the failures and you know, having a bad day the day before affect what it is you're trying to accomplish right now.
We're talking to Dan O'Brien, gold medalist and author of Clearing Hurdles, The Quest to Be the World's Greatest Athlete. And Dan, when you decided to write the book, it took some time, for sure. I mean, it's not like right after you won the gold medal, and you know a lot of athletes that jump in right to a book right after that. Why did it take you so much time to finally write it?
You know, after I won the gold medal, I actually wrote a fitness book that just explained my workout. It's got fitness tips in there and correct form for some of the Olympic lifts that we did. I didn't know when I was going to retire, and so I think that's why I took a long time to write the book. And it was years later, I just figured that I missed my window to write a book. And a good friend of mine who I became good friends with here in Arizona was a sports writer, and he encouraged me to write the book. He and I wrote the book together. But we got about halfway through, and then he had to move from Arizona to Miami. He got a job with CBS Sports, and we had to finish the book while we were on different sides of the country. And that last chapter, I will say, was the most difficult. It's the chapter is, you know, what it is I'm doing now. How do you wrap up a story like that? But I was so glad I wrote the book. I was able to put some of these things behind me. I continued to feel like an athlete. I didn't let that part of my life go until I finished the book. It really was an emotional thing to finish that book. And 1 month after the book came out, all of my records were broken by a young man by the name of Ashton Eaton, my American record, my U.S. meet record. So it was interesting. So I was really glad that I wrote the book, because now I've got my piece of decathlon history recorded.
And how did that, I mean, I know that, you know, you had that record for so long. Did it hurt you at all? Or what was your feeling? Especially you finished the book and then this happens. How do you feel from that?
It feels good to own a record. I actually broke the world record for the fastest game of hopscotch, believe it or not, and I held the world record for a year. And there's something about having a record, and especially a record. I held the American record for almost 20 years in the decathlon, and it felt good knowing that I was when I held the world record, it felt good knowing I was the best in the world ever, or the best ever in the world. And when I held the American record, it felt good to know that I was the best American in the event. I think it hurts a little bit to lose that record, but you know that these records are going to be broken at some point. And so I really encouraged the young man who broke my record, and I congratulated him afterwards. And it was interesting because my coach was at the track meet that he broke the record at as well. And so we said, let's just sit here and watch the record go down together.
But again, 2012 is like ups and downs, because you also were elected the U.S. Olympic Hall of Fame, and that's got to be huge as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. That was a real emotional moment for me. I'm in the Idaho Hall of Fame. I'm in the Oregon Sports Hall of Fame and the USA Track and Field Hall of Fame. And I really thought at the time, I was like, oh, I'm going in the U.S. Olympic Hall of Fame, and didn't think I'd have that, you know, such deep feelings. But going in with the class that I went in with, and that was, you know, the class that Mia Hamm had, you know, the soccer team that she was on, and some other people, it was really emotional, and you understand the power of the Olympics when something like that happens to you. And for me, you know, it all started when I was a kid, and everybody who's performed at that level and goes into the Olympic Hall of Fame, U.S. Olympic Hall of Fame, had that passion and just loved the Olympics when they were growing up.
So what's new with you right now, Dan? Update us on what's going on, and then especially after that, tell us where we can purchase the book as well.
Yeah, you know, you can purchase the book on Amazon, and you can find it at Barnes & Noble. You know, people, I've gotten a great response. I do motivational speaking. Groups will buy a bunch of books when I come in to speak. And so, you know, I wasn't sure what to expect, but the people that have read the book love the book. So I'd love to get it out there to more people. The things that I do now is I work with USA Track and Field on a regular basis, and they are a national governing body here in the United States for all of track and field, from little kids up to masters. Especially, you see us on the weekends. I work for NBC Sports Network, broadcasting track meets. I just did the pin relays. An interesting venture that I've been a part of the last couple of years, Andre Agassi has a new line of fitness equipment called Built, B-I-L-T, by Agassi and Reyes. And he and his longtime trainer, Gil Reyes, put a bunch of equipment together. It's the stuff that Andre competed on or trained on his whole entire career. And it's gone to market. We go to fitness shows. We sell it all over the country. And so, it, you know, it's just I'm doing things that I'm passionate about. I'm doing things that I enjoy. And actually that I'm good at.
Well, Dan, it's a tremendous story, and it's great that you're still, you know, getting out there, but you have a lot of different things going on, and that's great. And even as no longer an athlete, you definitely are inspiring people, and you're inspiring me as well in this interview to know about, hey, you're going to have those ups and downs, but what advice would you offer somebody who's going through a hard time right now, Dan?
Oh, just realize that tomorrow's a new day. Things are going to get better, and that, you know, the human spirit will always prevail. And if things are going rough and you're kind of going through some rough times, it's just a feeling. If we wait, you can wake up tomorrow and say, you know what, today's going to be a better day. And I guarantee you, if you wake up most days and say today's going to be a better day, it will be a better day. Attitude is everything.
Absolutely, Dan. Thanks again for calling the program. Enjoyed the conversation. Need to have you back on to give us updates of what's going on with your career and the success of the book. And hopefully, I'll know you're out in Pittsburgh next time, so maybe we can connect and have a cup of coffee or something. So thanks again for calling, Dan.
All right. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Take care, man. Okay. Bye-bye. You're listening to the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Radio Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley. Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, TotalTutor. And Pinterest, Neil Haley. And I always enjoy the Insightful Player series. And I tell you what, when you're talking about an athlete, as I was listening to another interview he had, talking about his faith, talking about fatherhood, and the importance of fatherhood, which is great when I hear about an educator. And then also talking about the giving back. What great things. So as we all know, the Insightful Player series is such an important part of it. And they partner with NFL players to help in the community. And they also do school assemblies. Go to insightfulplayer.com. And I'm so excited to welcome the program Super Bowl champion Benjamin Watson, former New England Patriot, now New Orleans Saint. Benjamin, how are you, man?
I'm doing well, my friend. Thank you for having me on.
We're excited to talk to you, and I think it's so important to talk about how important you look at your faith in leading and driving a lot of the initiatives you do off the field. I think that's fantastic.
Definitely. Well, I think your faith is something that is the core of who you are. And faith is not something that you add to what you do. It is who you are, and it gives you the reason that you do the things that you do. So, you know, when you look at playing football, you play football, obviously, because God gave you the ability, but you perform to your best because that's what Christ will want you to do, to perform it. And when you do those things, you have an opportunity to tell people about him. So it's all connected, and I'm really blessed and fortunate to be in the position where I am, and I feel like anything I can do to help someone else, and especially when we talk about children and doing things like fatherhood and promoting fatherhood and doing football clinics and those type of things and reaching out to those in need, that's just something that I feel is who we are and who we're called to be.
And your faith is so important to you, and that's tremendous. But why did you decide to start your foundation?
Great question. You know, you can do plenty of good work and charity without starting a foundation. But in 2009, my wife and I were living in New England. I was playing for the Patriots, and we had an idea. Well, she had an idea mostly, and came up with the name One More. And the whole idea of One More, which is the name of our foundation, is to spread the love and hope of Christ to one more soul. And we grew up, both of us, in families that it was important that we help people who were in need. It was important that we offer not just physical help, but also spiritual help to those who needed it. And when you look at the life of Jesus, the way that he told people, the way he reached the most people was when he didn't just tell them about who he was, although that's great, but he gave them a piece of bread. He met their physical needs, and then he told them that he was the bread of life. And our whole point is to meet people's needs, whether it be clothing or food, you know, hunger, education, those sorts of things, but to not just meet people's physical needs, but to tell them how they can have a relationship with Jesus Christ that will save them for eternity. So we came up with the idea of One More, and we started the foundation and made it an official 501c3 because we wanted to offer other people the opportunity to be involved, because there's a lot of people doing a lot of great things, and a lot of people want to do a lot of great things, but they might not have an avenue to do it. And so we wanted our foundation ultimately to be a conduit, an avenue for people to be able to do the great things that they want to, and to volunteer for certain events or to donate or whatever they want to do. We wanted to help facilitate that. So that's why we ended up making an official foundation.
That's definitely tremendous, Benjamin, because when you think about it, when you think about the whole fact of your foundation standing for your faith and helping another soul in need, helping somebody that truly needs it, and really bring that faith formation in the process, it's unlike a lot of other NFL athletes' foundations, which really will differentiate you from others, but also show how much you truly care for other people through your faith.
Definitely, definitely. You know, there's a lot of guys. You know, my teammates do some awesome things, and you know, many of them have you know, huge foundations that do a lot, and there's a need for that, definitely. And a lot of times we overlap. You know, a lot of guys will do some of the same things, but we feel like there's a spiritual component to it that is more important than doing something nice for someone. Although that's very important, and we always wanted to tie the spiritual component to it because ultimately, we believe that is the most important aspect of a person is the spiritual aspect. So if we're doing football clinics, like we have a football clinic coming up this weekend where we'll have about 150 or so kids, and we'll teach them football basics and those sorts of things. But we also want to make sure that we talk to their spirits and that we tell them about the Lord, that we tell them about discipline and about self-control and about teamwork and about all those character traits, because we feel like it's important to be able to tie anything that we do to spiritual truth, because that's ultimately who we're created to be.
And that's an interesting type of football camp, because you're really getting to know the kids. You're and I'm sure you'll be checking up with the kids yearly to make sure that they're on the right path and their family. So you're really creating this relationship, not just with the kids for that camp, but also the relationship for life after they play football.
Yeah.
Whatever they're doing, you want to see them grow up to be great adults in society. So you're looking to care more, not just about can he throw the ball far, or can he catch the ball fast, catch the ball or hit hard, or is he a big star? No, you're looking at the individual person and how that person is going to be a great member of society and a community. And through faith and through the faith of Christ, you can bring that to them.
Well, I think people really respond when they know that you care enough to spend time with them and to speak directly to them. And when we have these clips, and we've this is about the eighth one, and you know, we like to do one in New Orleans. It just didn't come together this year, but when I was in Cleveland, we were able to do a couple in Cleveland for a week there. But it's amazing in Rock Hill, where we have the clinic in Rock Hill, South Carolina, how many kids come every single year, and they come up to you and say, do you remember from last year? And I remember some of them, but some of them, they've grown so much, I don't recognize them at all. But the biggest difference is they care because you came and you spoke directly to them, and you didn't just tell them to go catch the football, but you actually spoke into their personal lives. And I think that's what differentiates the clinic that we have, is that you have a group of volunteers who come out. I mean, there's so many volunteers. So many people, like I said, so many people want to be involved with something that is bigger than what they are, and that's how people view a lot of the events that we're able to do.
So for the churches, Benjamin, are they all on board for sure with the Faith Initiative, right? I'm sure a lot of churches want to volunteer their time and help in this process as well to grow the foundation, right?
Yeah, well, definitely. And a lot of the events, you know, for example, we've done, you know, Christmas toy giveaways where we create big Christmas, you know, clothing or toys or books. Shopping stores inside of a church or inside of a YMCA or a rec center or something. And we have people who maybe couldn't afford too many gifts. We have them come in and they'll shop for their kids, quote unquote, shop for their kids. And it's amazing how many, you know, churches have volunteered, you know, churches come out to volunteer and support. Because again, you know, even if we're doing something like that, we want to make sure that we spread the gospel.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You want to make sure that's the number one thing. And then when I also was listening to an interview, which was absolutely touched by your story, Benjamin, you talked about the importance of fatherhood and to be involved in the Fatherhood Initiative. And this kind of give you my background. We see in my faith the so important about the father. And the father needs to be a leader. The father needs to not be in the background allowing mom to do everything, but the father needs to be there as a leader, a guide, a mentor, all these important things. So I was so excited to hear about fatherhood and how important it is to you and being involved in the Fatherhood Initiative. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, well, the Fatherhood Initiative, you know, I can't claim that. It wasn't my idea, but I was invited to be a part of it, and I jumped at the chance. The NFL, you know, as you know, the NFL has about 1,600 or so men, almost final rosters. It's probably a couple thousand, a little over a couple thousand that are involved now. But the NFL touches so many people throughout this country, men, women, boys and girls. It has a great amount of influence. And the father is, like you said, an important part of our life. You know, your father can speak to you in ways that nobody else can. And so, the NFL, in conjunction with a lady named Dr. Meg Meeker, she's a pediatrician. She's written a lot of books. Through her experiences, she's seen how not having a father, or having a father who wasn't involved, or having a father who was abusive, how that negatively affects so many kids. She wanted to get some guys together in the NFL that were fathers, not perfect fathers, but guys who have been fathers and who have had struggles and successes and are willing to talk about them and kind of showcase that fatherhood can be done in America, that fatherhood can be something that we can hold our heads high about. And it doesn't have to be a quote-unquote statistic, that fathers can make a difference, and try to encourage men that, you know, you can be a good father. Even if you didn't have a good, great father, you can do it. You can have these struggles like all of us do. You don't have to be perfect, but if you're willing, you can be a good father, and God can use you in the lives of your children. So we put together a video, and the video has you can view it on the NFL website as well as the NFLPA website. You can go to my website, thebenjaminwatson.com, and there's links to it there. But I think this is the beginning of kind of a revolutionary thought in the NFL, and with player engagement, with NFL player engagement, trying to showcase fathers, you know, not just on Father's Day, but have it be something that we kind of incorporate into our training.
For us, for especially for a single family home, and seeing that the difficulties that they go through, a lot of them they're able to overcome those things. But to show the importance of a father, because a lot of times even if fathers are separated or not together, and they have to still see the importance of taking care of their children, they have to still see the importance of helping them through different things. And it just really strengthens a family when there's a father who's involved. And I'm so glad the NFL is doing this. us. And definitely, we need to definitely check that out at your website and also at the NFL website. Benjamin, how excited are you about the season? You really, especially last year, you know, your guys were getting close. You played really tough, and it just didn't happen. But what do you think of the Saints' opportunities this year?
Man, you know, there's a few teams in the NFL that have a chance, and the Saints are definitely one of the organizations from top to bottom, it's first class. You know, being an outsider looking in and being in New England, which is another great organization, and going to Cleveland and just seeing the success that the Saints have had, especially since Coach Payton has been here, really had a lot of respect for this organization. So to have the chance to come here and play has definitely been a privilege, and the fans, I believe, are really second to none. There's such great support for the team here, even when they weren't doing well. So you can imagine now that the team is doing well, the great support that that the fans give to this team. So there's a few teams that have a shot, and I believe the Saints are definitely one of them. You know, we're coming off a year where we made it to the playoffs. We got our first road win as an organization going to Philadelphia. We lost to the eventual Super Bowl champs twice last year in the playoffs as well. And we really feel like this year can be special for us. That being said, we all started at the same spot. Everybody's heading into training camp in about a month. What we do in training camp, the bricks that we stack, the blocks that we stack up, will give us the foundation to move forward into the season. But the expectations here are high, as they always are. Our accountability is always high, and so we're excited.
Well, I definitely think you guys, just think about it, you were that close to beating the Seahawks, and they were the eventual champions. So, again, and you guys had the type of team that definitely could have beat San Francisco. So it just was that wrong team at the wrong time that was just unbelievable last year. But every year, the NFL, that's what's so nice about the NFL. Every year, any team has a chance to win the NFL Super Bowl championship. You never know who it's going to be every year. So starting at training camp is when it begins. And, Benjamin, you just mentioned the training camp's gonna be located in West Virginia. Where in West Virginia?
Yeah, it's gonna be at the Greenbrier. It's a resort in West Virginia, White Sulphur Springs, I believe, West Virginia. You know, a lot of teams go away for training camp. I've never been on a team to go away until now, but I think it's something that Coach Payton may have wanted to do just to kind of get us away to somewhere else and have the team kind of bond in that way. We'll be there for about 3 weeks, and then we'll come here to have the rest of training camp here in New Orleans.
All right. Well, cool. Benjamin, again, more information on your work. Can we find you, the website and your Twitter?
Yes, sir. TheBenjaminWatson.com, the website, and Twitter is at Benjamin S. Watson. S is in Sam. My middle name is Seth. At Benjamin S. Watson.
You're such a humble man, Benjamin. I mean, an NFL star, you know, Super Bowl champion that's so down to earth, that can have a conversation with somebody. That's so key, and I'm sure you are a tremendous role model for children. When you get in front of them, you're an NFL Super Bowl champ, and you're going to talk to them, and you're going to be wanting to know about their lives. You're going to make such a tremendous difference. So good talking to you, Benjamin.
I appreciate those words, and thanks for having me on anytime.
All right, take care, man. See ya. Okay, bye-bye. Remember to go to insightfulplayer.com again to find out more information on Chrissy Carew's players. They're just phenomenal. At insightfulplayer.com, you can purchase her book. You can learn about the school program, school assemblies that they provide as well with the great NFL athletes that truly are insightful players. Have a great day. We'll talk tomorrow, and you're listening to the Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Radio Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley. Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, TotalTutor. And Pinterest, Neil Haley. And always interesting when I talk to actresses. And what's interesting about this actor in so many ways is she is an actress, also a comedian, and a writer. So she's the jack of all trades in so many ways. She's on HBO right now, so I'm excited to learn about what's going on in HBO and her other projects. So I want to welcome the program Megan Sousa Meyer. Megan, thanks for calling. How are you, Megan?
I'm well. How are you?
Excellent. Fantastic.
Hey.
And for our audience, can you tell us a little bit how you got into the entertainment field? When did that bug come, and what was it? What were you involved at first?
Well, it's funny whenever I even go into this conversation, you know, I've heard so many actresses and entertainers with their stories and how they got there and how interesting to me they are. And so I just always think, like, what was that moment for me, you know, because it's just stemmed back as long as I can ever remember. It's just always been something that I've just gravitated towards, even watching young videos of myself as a young child, you know, performing and being in front of everybody is something that I've always done. But in particular, I started in writing poetry and short stories, and that was always my number one creative outlet. And I honestly, it was just something that was so fun for me, and it just grew and grew and grew. And, you know, it got to the point where we would make, my mother and I would put all of my poems together and make poetry books. So we just started to grow and evolve from there. And as far as like TV and film, you know, I have so many icons in that world, and being with Jim Carrey or Meryl Streep, seeing Death Becomes Her for the first time, that was one of my favorite films growing up. Jim Carrey has always been a number one idol for me as well. So it's like when I see people's work, you know, and growing up, I just always, the main thought I would have is, that looks like so much fun, and I could totally do that, and I so want to be there in that world. And using my imagination and belief and my make-believe world, as all kids do, is something that I never grew out of. So it's like, okay, this has to mean something. What do I do with this, you know? And yes, that's when I started pursuing it from there, because it wouldn't go away, you know? So I figured this is where I have to be, you know?
Interesting. You can look in all three areas. You can look at writing through poetry. That got you interested in writing through creativity. You look at your love for Jim Carrey and comedy. That's what got you involved in comedy. And then you look at some of your other loves on film, and there you go. There goes the acting. So all those things together. And I think that's important to have in Hollywood now, Megan, right? Wouldn't you agree? Because really, you have to be able to do it all. In certain ways, because
it's so true. It really is very true. And times have really changed a lot for Hollywood. And, you know, when I really tapped into just turning my creative writing skill into actual script writing, was about 4 years ago when I wrote my first short script. And it was funny because I was sitting, you know, at my template on final draft, and I'm like, okay, interior, period, you know. And it's just like this whole new learning curve on writing for script formats. So I started writing short scripts, and I was like, man, I love this, and I love being able to, you know, just completely change my storytelling into a different format and just completely, you know, convey my own emotions and creative energy out of this. And, you know, so far I've had really great responses with that, so it's just been, you know, a crazy ride on its own. And just developing that skill.
Well, definitely a crazy ride. Let's go first of all to the project at HBO. Tell us how you got involved in that whole thing. Yeah.
Sure. Actually, it's a funny story. And it's all through, you know, chain of command, I guess, and just linking with people and being at the right place at the right time. I actually met this casting director, Brittany Grooms, a time back and working with a friend in a casting session, completely different project. And so I'm actually brought in to assist behind the camera with the director and just taking the auditions. And of course, I jumped to every opportunity like this is, because it's such a learning experience behind the camera versus in front of the camera. So I'm like, sure, yeah, I'll help out, no problem. So we get there, and the casting director sees me, and she kind of has this weird look on her face. And he's like, yes, this is my name, she's helping out. And she's like, wait, you're not auditioning? And I was like, no. And she's like, wait, do you want to read this copy? So it's a different project. I ended up reading the copy, and I booked it. Well, the project fell through, and ended up not going through production. And she reaches out to me about 2 months later. I was like, hey, I thought about you for this film. Come in and audition, and let's just see how it goes. And I was like, yeah, sure, no problem. So I go in and audition. And to be honest with you, I had no idea where the project was going. It's actually a film written and produced and directed by Kimberly Towns as a UCLA thesis film. And so I auditioned for the part. I got the part. We filmed the project. We had about a week of pickups. And then about a year later, we still had, I hadn't seen any footage of anything. About a year later, she gives me a call, and she's like, hey, we got into this festival, the American Black Film Festival 2012 in Miami. You totally need to be there. And I was like, wow, this is huge. Also, I can't wait. So you go to the festival. We were actually in a film contest, a short film contest, through HBO sponsoring the film contest, through the festival, the American Black Film Festival, ABFF. Well, we had an official selection of five, and we actually, they picked us up, and they're airing us for 2 years. And it's been such an incredible ride, and the film itself has such a great message with, you know, the issues of bullying and touching on those topics. So it's really been a very powerful film and movement that I've been a part of, because I myself had issues of being bullied throughout school growing up. So, you know, I really identify with this character to the T, and it's been such a blessing, and I'm just so happy that, you know, HBO, you know, has granted us something like this. Like, it's such a huge deal, and it was, like, almost unbelievable. I'm like, wow, I had no idea that this small short film would be on one of the biggest networks, you know, and it's still running on there. So we're just like, hey, this is so amazing, you know. And we've, you know, met so many amazing people along the way and made some amazing friends along the way. And it's opened up quite a bit of doors, and we're just really happy that we have some new air dates. So we're back on in July and August. So it's been great.
Fantastic. So basically the project, you won something in Miami that got you on HBO, it sounds like, right? Is that correct?
Right. So, exactly. So HBO sponsors, they have their own short film contest within the festival, the ABFF festival. And we were one of five of the films in the official selection. So what they did was each film individually contracted, and they acquired us for 2 years. So this is in 2012. This is, I believe, our last year running. But they own the film. They completely control the programming and everything like that. So they have complete control. So it's like, yay, this is great, you know. And you don't have control of your film. You want HBO to have control of it.
Exactly.
So it's just like, we have no complaints. This is amazing, you know. So it's just been a really great opportunity for all of us. It's such a great calling card. They're like, yes, it's amazing, you know. And so that's just been a really great additive to, you know, working on a film that you don't expect to, you know, even be exposed at that level, you know. And it's been great because, you know, again, you know, especially in the topic of bullying, which is something so heavily, it's a big issue now, not just in school physically, but also, you know, the cyberbullying. So it goes both ways. And, you know, we've had a lot of people and parents and kids reach out, you know, about the film. So it's just been really great and touching to even know that, you know, a project that you worked on and you put so much into is affecting so many people on the other side, which ultimately is what, as entertainers, you know, I feel on my behalf is my goal. You know, it's like, before I even got to this point, you know, it's like, I look at these people, like, you know, your Meryl Streeps or your Jim Carreys or your Ryan Gosling, or, you know, you name it. You know, you're in this position for a reason. And, you know, you have so much power to influence so many people. Why not do it for the benefit of them? And, you know, again, to be attached to a project like this, it's like, what a great day to do that at, you know, at a starting, you know, for an actress, you know, pursuing their career at this stage. You know, I just felt like, you know, it was such a strong foot forward, I think, for me and everyone else involved in that project.
Exactly,
you know, just even be a part of it, you know, because it's just a great message, I think, all the way around.
Well, absolutely. And so that's so interesting in so many ways, Megan, when you're talking about something like this and then the opportunity and what's happening. But then also you have some stuff going on also. And so people can go in July 10th, the short film will be on air again, and we can talk about it, maybe bring you back for another time
sure.
to talk specifically on that, especially when we get closer to the air date. The stand-up comedy, tell us about, you're in the Comedy Store, and do you ever travel to Pittsburgh's comedy place, or are you pretty much in staying in the LA area for comedy?
You know what? It's funny. Okay, so comedy, actually, this is the funny thing about comedy with stand up with me. It's a very unique story because it goes hand in hand with the comedy series that's been developed. you know, I, once again, I grew up, most of my teachings came from television shows. So, you know, if it's The Martin Show, if it was Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Seinfeld, MASH, you name it, you know. These are the shows, Golden Girls, et cetera, you know. So I love Lucy shows. Like, such an array of TV comedy shows have influenced me in such a way, and just something from my family of, like, natural-born comics. You know, I never thought that I would pursue a career specifically in stand-up comedy. So it actually came up last year. My husband, you know, just kept saying, like, you should try it, you know, because he knows how much I love it. And, you know, like, you should try it. I'm like, absolutely not. No. No, I can't do that. He's like, no, I think you're funny. You should try it. Well, funny enough, very oddly enough, July 4th last year, I went into my acting studio for, you know, it was just a special class on July 4th. And I ran into an actress who's in my normal class. We were teamed up for a just performance scene together. So we were just chatting, and she's like, yeah, I'm working at this comedy club. And I was like, really? What do you do there? And she's like, yeah, I'm working the tickets. And I'm like, you know, it's interesting because I just felt like this was like some type of door opening opportunity. And I asked, well, hey, are they hiring? And she's like, yeah, actually they are. So of course, I send my email out right away. And then I get the job, and I'm just working tickets. And this is at Flappers Comedy Club in Burbank. And it was such a great learning experience. I was surrounded by so many seasoned comics, new comics, comics who have been doing it for months, comics trying it for the first time, you know, have learner comics that, you know, we all know and see on TV and on the air. And, it was a learning experience in a way where I was absorbing. I was just like a sponge and just absorbing it all, and in the flow of the comedy club and the scene. And the first thing I realized is comedy is, stand-up comedy life is so different than TV film commercial.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, they're overlapping, you know, loops, as I'm sure you know, as far as, like, a comedian, of course, being in a commercial or a film. Of course, there's overlapping. But as far as the atmosphere in the world, it's so different because comedians are individual. You know, when you're working on a film, you're working with a collective. When you're working on a TV show, you're working with a collective. Stand-up comedy is just you, and that's it. And you're projecting your ideas and your thoughts and your processes about the world and yourself to an audience of people that you don't know. You know, and so the whole thought of this was just like, no way, I'm not doing this. So when I finally did one open mic, and it scared the hell out of me, and, you know, I got done. I was like, well, you know what, that wasn't so bad. You know, I feel like I need to do a little more. That was just the beginning. And I did, and I just kept doing open mics here and there. Damon Williams would often come through the comedy club, and he gave me some pointers, and, you know, he watched an open mic of mine, and I was like, yeah, you know, this is something that I can do, and it's different. But at the same time, as an actress, it's strengthening so many other skill sets for me, improv, and just being very quick and witty. And I just noticed, like, my confidence level as an actress started to increase by tenfold by, like, the second month I was doing it. So I actually professionally just started doing shows. It was my first show while I was in Germany, here in California in January. So I'm actually just doing shows and taking all opportunities wherever they come, because I'm still, you know, it's so new for me. And some people, like, you know, think stand-up comedy, you automatically have to be like Dave Chappelle.
No, you don't. Yeah.
You know,
there's always one that warms up Dave Chappelle. And that's where you're at right now. You want to get it to the next level, but, you know, it's worth it. Hey, you're a professional comedian now. So what a unbelievable thing. And the last thing I want to get to is the whole thing with the Connor Lynch Foundation and the original comedy series New Push with the Connor Lynch Foundation. Tell me all about what's going on with that.
Yeah, so I actually met a woman named Jerry Lynch at a comedy club, oddly enough. And this television show, I had this idea when I almost dropped my phone in the toilet at the movie theater. And I had this random idea this night, and I just kept pondering on this idea, like, man, we are so attached and addicted to these things. Like, I almost dropped my phone in the toilet. This is ridiculous, you know, and I caught myself. And, you know, I had this idea, and it still hadn't gelled all the way together. Once it started developing, and then I had my first script, I actually met Jerry Lynch at Slacker Comedy Club for hosting one of her fundraisers there. And what happened is her son was killed in a texting driving accident.
Wow. Yeah.
And she now has a foundation in his name, in olivecollar.org. And they raise awareness, they do different events. Once a year they do, I think, a 4K or a 10K run. They do all different types of things to raise the awareness, and she travels. She does so much, and Jerry Lynch is such an amazing person. And so we found a way to partner up in terms of, you know, how can we send this message out together, which, you know, we ended up coming together on that, partnering up, and, you know, she's behind it, she supports the show, she loves the idea, she loves the message behind it, so that's where we are now, is, you know, just putting it out there, because, you know, the spec script is finished, we have content, and, you know, we'll be shopping it around soon, so, yeah, so that's how we partnered up with Jerry Lynch, and she's now, yeah.
There's some real time for you to definitely come back to talk about your projects again. So we'll keep in touch via Facebook for our fans. How can they keep in touch with you?
Absolutely. So you can keep in touch with me via MeganSousa.com. Please visit the website, FredUnplugged.com. That's the name of the television series, the comedy show. And all of my handles are @yo_megs. All of the handles for the TV show are @FredUnplugged. It's really definitely, it's a great cause. We have a very big message to push behind it. So, you know, we're definitely looking to get as much support from the community as possible. So we're really excited about, you know, launching it soon. So.
All right, well, fantastic. Thanks for calling. We're going to stay in touch and
have you
back. Before the event, when the show premieres in July, I'll make sure I can check it out, and then we'll have to come back on the show and talk about it. All right? Sound good?
Okay, great.
All right, thanks,
Megan.
Take care. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks, you too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Education Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, and now Pinterest. And I'm getting followers on Pinterest, and I've never even been active, but now I am active on it. I just got to figure it out. I'm really excited to welcome the program 2010 silver medalist hockey player for the U.S. hockey team, Karen Thatcher. Karen, thanks for calling. And when I saw, you know, specifically what the women did this year, and I saw that you were interested in coming on the show, I said I had to have you on because of that reason alone.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And
that's the first question I'm going to ask, because, I mean, I'm sure you got a lot of some sound bites on this, especially with you were hoping a gold medal for the women, and then it just didn't happen. And it was probably the most dramatic part of the entire Olympics, in my opinion.
Yeah, it was an incredible hockey game and absolutely heart-wrenching to watch so many friends of mine and former teammates, you know, come so close to their goal and lose it in that way. But as far as, you know, a platform for women's hockey and a stage to kind of really exhibit what the sport has become, you could not have asked for a better hockey game. Those were two of the best teams that I've seen in a long time compete in one of the best games I've seen in a long time. And thankfully, a lot of people saw it, and it was a great hockey game. And you know, both teams, I think at the end, deserve to go home with gold medals, but you can't do it that way. So it was an awesome exhibition for women's hockey, and hopefully we'll continue to generate a lot of support and a lot of interest in the game.
Well, I'm enthused to see hockey do this, especially when, I mean, have the coverage of the Olympics and everything. You know, women's basketball has done just a tremendous job to really bring women's sports up to the level that it is today. And then you see the sports like in the summer games with women, and I think it's fantastic to see women athletes really having huge fan followings and superstardom in so many aspects. And I think that it's good to finally see the hockey getting its due, in my opinion.
No, I think it's incredible. And as you said, these are elite athletes. These are women who devote their entire lives to their sport, and they are incredible athletes. And, you know, except for the Olympics, they often don't get the exposure and the recognition that they deserve. And they are making a lot of sacrifices to devote themselves to their sports. They're great role models for young children, and a lot of times they don't get that recognition. And so having the Olympics and having this spotlight on them is awesome, and it's a great, you know, momentum moving forward. Women's basketball is an excellent role model for hockey, and hopefully we can develop a league that's as successful as the WNBA and, you know, maybe have a little bit more coverage, not in the Olympic year, but in other years as well.
We're talking to Karen Thatcher, silver medalist from the 2010 U.S. From the Olympics, U.S. hockey player. And Karen, it's kind of funny. We're gonna definitely talk life after hockey. But I after having this last sports interview I had before yours, I'm like feeling like I'm a sportscaster instead of just an interviewer of a variety of people. But thinking about that in the long run, in certain aspects, do you think this is going to happen? I mean, why hasn't it? I mean, people don't think that women are tough enough to play hockey. Honestly, this sport is finally growing. Kind of tell us the history of this, because really, I wouldn't have known, and I looked at your bio on Wiki, that you played professional hockey, and that really it's not
right.
Being highlighted. But tell me, what's the reason why women aren't getting their due yet in hockey, in your opinion?
If you look back, really, there wasn't a national program or a developed program until 1990. So it's really a relatively young sport on the national level in the U.S. And we didn't enter the Olympics until 1998. So growth of the sport at the youth level didn't really come until after that point. And so as far as widespread players, female players, we really didn't have that fan base for a long time. So now that you look around and there's, you know, when I was a kid, I grew up in Massachusetts, there was really only one girls team for me to choose from. Now these kids have 6-7 options just in this one area alone. So now we're talking that we actually have a fan base for it. Furthermore, that having that, you know, increased player pool just means that we've increased the game that much more. You know, back in 1998, there weren't that many women's hockey players out there, so there really wasn't a pool of players to keep that game at a high level. And now we've got a really deep pool across the nation and around the world to really make it a competitive sport. And so I think it's taken, you know, 20, 30 years, but as we continue to grow and, you know, have more longevity with our sport at that level, we'll increasingly have that support, you know, from fans and people who want to watch the game. Also, hockey isn't really the cheapest sport to run to put on a team. So
exactly.
Until we have that really high product to put on the ice, you're not really going to get that many investors to, you know, throw their money towards a sport that really doesn't have a quality product. Well, now we have a quality product, and we have something that we can present, and I think we're going to start to generate that interest not only from, you know, fans, but now supporters and people who are able to kind of invest in the sport.
Well, you need to start the Karen Thatcher Foundation to raise money for...
I would love to. Maybe that's my next step.
Because I mean, they do it for figure skating and all these different places. This would be a fantastic idea. Because I was thinking about it. I mean, one of my girls who is a little more rough and tumble. She's gonna take after my height. I'm 6'10", and I was a former professional wrestler. Karen, that would be a perfect sport if, again, affordability. I'm a middle class family, and the amount of money I spend in dance, and I have 5 kids, by the way.
Oh yeah.
And all these different costs. Hockey is so expensive. And do you see with the boys level that it's a very too expensive a sport to keep a lot of people in the United States to really be involved in this?
I think that's a big factor. I spend a lot of time around, you know, youth, both boys and girls, and just the cost that these people are paying now to play on select teams and travel teams and for the private coaches and for their top end equipment and for all of that. It's really exorbitant. And to really compete at the highest level is becoming, I think, almost more exorbitant, which I think is, you know, that part we might want to look at a little bit long term. There isn't as much as, you know, I played growing up, I have my brother's hand-me-down stuff. You don't really see that as much now in these kids, the ones who are really competing. So I think that is a bit of a limiting factor in that, you know, to play basketball, you need a pair of sneakers and a ball. And so it's a little bit less of a startup cost,
yes,
than hockey and the entire skate, helmet, glove, stick, everything that you need to just get into the sport. So I think that is a limiting factor and something that we need to look at moving forward. And there are a number of different programs sponsored through USA Hockey, and they are grassroots programs that they're trying to kind of decrease that startup cost so that people can try out the sport and try it for free and see if they like it so that they can kind of encourage more people to get into it. But, you know, it is an issue moving forward.
Exactly, Karen. So basically, once you're talking about this, now how many girls programs are out there? I mean, honestly, if it wasn't for the Olympics, I wouldn't be thinking about girls playing hockey. And it's the truth. I mean, how many programs are out there, let's say, in the United States where girls can play competitive hockey at a younger age
right.
in the area? Is there
a lot?
Okay.
There are a good amount in, you know, the hotbed areas. So there are a good amount in Massachusetts, there's a few in Connecticut, a lot in Minnesota, a number in Michigan, a few in Illinois, a couple in California, a couple in Colorado. And similar to kind of, I think, Ventop as well, the other areas, not as much. The warmer climates, you don't really see it as much. And you will see girls play with the boys in those areas still, kind of like, you know, I started out playing with boys when we lived in Connecticut when I was first starting hockey, and you still see that in those other areas, but it isn't quite as widespread as men's hockey.
Okay, so from there in that process, so like a city like Pittsburgh, there, I don't wonder how many women girls leagues there are out there. They're probably not a ton.
There are actually two really good Pittsburgh youth programs right now.
Okay.
Well, there are two girls programs, and I'm blanking on names of them. One is like the Selects, and one is the but they're two excellent Pittsburgh programs.
I'll have to definitely check those out, especially, and consider that as another sport opportunity for my girls. So, Karen, life after your passion is absolutely unbelievable, as you're talking about. I mean, you're carrying this. You're one of the only. There's not that many that could say they're a silver medalist women's hockey. Because remember, you said how many years since the U.S. women's hockey really got in place. So you're going to always be remembered at that beginning process. But then when you finally had to hang it up, no longer playing professional hockey, was it a difficult decision?
Yes and no. I mean, I was slightly fortunate in that my career was ended with an injury. I got my third concussion when I was knocked out last February, and that was kind of my worst concussion and the end of it for me. And so in terms of a decision, kind of made it for me, but in terms of it being easy as a process to kind of let go of hockey as a player, it was still incredibly difficult and incredibly emotional, and I still had to go through the entire grieving and loss process. So the decision, you know, I think it would have been a hard one for me to make myself, so kind of glad that that part was taken out of my hands, but you know, losing something that you were so focused on for so long was still, you know, very difficult.
Absolutely, and so finally, when you, because you were forced into that decision, did you have any idea what you wanted to do?
Thankfully, I did. I had my eventual career goal is I would like to get my doctorate and my PhD in physical therapy, so clinical doctorate and PhD. In physical therapy, kind of practice and conduct research as well. And then I always want to be involved in hockey, whether it's coaching private clients or coaching youth teams, somehow giving back to the sport and being involved in kind of, you know, my physical therapy research. I'd like to orient towards female hockey players and kind of the knee, shoulder, head injuries that we see at a high incident rate in them.
Okay, so then, so basically, your coaching, your private coaching, and working as a physical therapist are pretty much what you're doing right now, correct?
I'm going to school right now, so I start my program, and currently I'm working as a personal trainer, and then doing private coaching.
Okay, so let's talk about being the entrepreneur in the private coaching business. This
sure.
Come easy for you, or because again, you're always training, and you kept training all the time. And said, let me teach others how to do this.
Yeah, right after the Olympics in 2010, I went and coached 2 years at Providence College. And so I had a little bit of college coaching experience. And all the way through, I think I'm someone who I understand the game a lot more than I'm naturally gifted at it. So I kind of always knew that I wanted to coach and, like, pass on my passion and knowledge. So it came pretty naturally because I've coached at camps and then coaching in college. So the actual coaching of it when I get into a session, very natural. But as you mentioned, the entrepreneurial part and finding clients and setting up ice times and all that, that was a little bit more difficult. And I was thankful that I fell upon CoachUp.com, and they kind of take the guesswork and the difficulty out of that. They set up, you put in your profile and you set up where and when you're available, and they'll help connect you with clients, and they have liability insurance. And so that was a huge help for me just to get my business off the ground.
That's interesting, Karen. And I think that that's the key, and is to have someone help find your leads and help you so that you have the protection you need, especially with certain things that can happen being a coach, being a tutor. I mean, I own a tutoring consulting company. You need to have that liability insurance, but a lot of people can't carry that kind of price tag. So a website like that is very helpful for you. How did you find out about this, Karen?
I was just looking into private coaching and looking into different options and how to get myself out there, and I happened upon it on the internet through a Google search, and it was the best thing that could have happened to me. And, you know, I was looking through it, and they offer coaches for all different sports, whether, you know, football, basketball, everything, as well as, like, strength and conditioning. So it was great for me just to kind of go through other people's profiles, see what they put up, and then be able to kind of promote myself and what I'm able to offer in hockey, and then put myself out there and connect with clients in my area.
So tell me a bit about the whole coaching thing. So you're coaching hockey. Are you going individual one-on-one types of stuff with your coaching business? Tell us about that.
Right now I'm doing all one-on-ones. I'll do small groups as well, 2 to 4 people. But everything I have right now is one-on-one. I do strength and conditioning coaching as well.